You're facing a big medical decision. Who will help you call the shots?
I stop women on the street if I saw a chemo head, as we call it, or a pink shirt that said survivor. I would hunt them down.
And what's your doctor's role? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
And we watch how their brain changes as that skill becomes learned.
I call it one of the final frontiers in body odor analysis.
All those tiny pores within this charcoal bit, holding water.
You can basically sequence an entire genome in the matter of weeks.
I've worked with other species before, but these mice I'm madly in love
Where
with.
Where do you draw the line between what is necessary to discuss?
Oh my gosh, it's out!
How did they do that?
This is our opportunity. Open your eyes. This is it.
On today's show, as sea levels rise, what's the future of wetlands? Also, coping with the emotional impact of the Ebola crisis and a pile of stinky, rotting coffee offers a lesson in public health. But first up, when you have a serious illness and there are several treatment options, who should choose the best path? You? Your doctor? There's a culture shift in medicine and a lot of support these days for something called shared decision making. It's the idea that doctors and patients decide together what's the best way to go. But experts are learning that individual patients have varying appetites for wading into the details of medical probabilities and treatment risks. Tanya English reports.
About a year ago, when Megan DiNascimento first learned she had breast cancer, she was a little tamped down from her normal, bright self.
In the beginning, it was very overwhelming. I had two long appointments with these doctors, with an oncologist and a breast surgeon. And to be honest, I don't remember anything that they said.
DiNascimento wears neon yellow glasses and teaches six indoor cycling classes every week. She's the mother of teenagers. This is a woman who knows how to speak up. But when she was diagnosed with a large aggressive tumor and the doctor laid out the treatment plan, early on, DiNascimento didn't ask many questions.
I believed them. I thought, you're going to cure my cancer and I will do whatever you say.
But after months of chemotherapy, there was another big decision.
So that was when I had to decide whether I wanted a lumpectomy or a mastectomy.
A lumpectomy is a surgery to remove just the tumor. That choice meant a quicker initial recovery, but weeks and weeks of follow-up radiation therapy. A mastectomy is more invasive, with more recovery time. And she worried she'd have to really rely on other people.
Every day I flip-flopped.
The survival rate after both surgeries is about the same. And this time, the doctor didn't say, do this or do that. DiNascimento thought maybe the surgeon was pushing for breast-conserving surgery, but actually, she isn't sure.
When I got to see him, I chickened out. I didn't ask him. I thought that all of my doctors should have had a meeting together, had this meeting of the minds where it was my oncologist, my breast surgeon, my gynecologist, my primary, everyone that it was involved, and just said, what should we do with Megan? All right, those that think mastectomy, raise your hand. And whatever the decision was, the majority ruled, I would have went with that.
Later on, we'll hear what DiNascimento decided. But the fact that she and other patients have treatment options at all reflects how sophisticated American medicine has become.
40 years ago, often there wasn't that much that medicine could do for you, let alone a choice of different pathways.
Margaret O'Kane serves on the board of the Informed Medical Decisions Foundation. She says during a health crisis, many patients want a second opinion and treatment recommendation from their primary care provider. Often that's the person they know best. But O'Kane says concerns about overreaching or malpractice can keep a doctor silent.
They feel, I think, at times they don't want to get between the specialist and the patient. It's not simple. None of this is simple.
Part of shared decision-making includes helping patients pinpoint what they care about most. When two alternatives are equally good, Fox Chase surgeon David Chin says a patient's way of life can be the deciding factor.
It could be as simple as your treatment could take 3 days or it could take 8 weeks. Does that matter to you from your work life, for your family life?
Patients ask Chen all the time, what would you do? But he tries to work around his personal biases when he's guiding a patient.
I tend to steer certain patients away from surgery because surgery itself has risks. And there will be some people who will say, I understand those risks, but I can't live with leaving this cancer inside my body, and I really need to have the cancer out. We respect what a patient chooses.
Back to Mount Airy resident Megan DiNascimento. Her choice was lumpectomy or mastectomy. We caught up with her at a convention called Living Beyond Breast Cancer. She was celebrating milestones with friends from Facebook.
How about people are more than 5 years out?
Yo, go Nancy! Go Nancy!
In a hall full of women making scarves and buzz cuts look chic after chemotherapy, DiNascimento stands out. Her graying pixie cut suits her compact body and her big personality.
That's my oncologist. Yeah. Woo! That's my oncologist.
So funny.
She's really cute, too.
Yes, her doctor is cute. But DiNascimento decided she needed more guidance than she was getting from her medical team. She joined an online support group and started looking for advice everywhere.
I stopped women on the street if I saw a chemo head, as we call it, or a pink shirt that said survivor. I would hunt them down. And actually, they were happy to show me their breasts whenever possible. And this is what my surgeon did for me, and I feel great. I look great.
DiNascimento says the advice from other women helped her make her own final decision. Lisa, Jennifer, Nancy, Christina, especially Christina, whose own sister's cancer came back after a lumpectomy.
I remember that conversation we had. I think we were texting or Facebook messaging at like 11 o'clock at night, and so important. When I was making that decision, I remember that conversation, and I appreciate that.
DiNascimento decided on a double mastectomy. It's the option with the slightly less risk of the cancer returning.
It was easy to put on my calendar, and it was easy to tell women, you know, I'm in control, and I made this decision, and I'm going for it. I'm a rock star. But it was hard.
For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Our universe, with all of its mysteries, is about to come into sharper view with the help of a new telescope that's being built as we speak. It's 3 times bigger than anything available on Earth currently. And joining us now to discuss what the new tool brings to the table is Derek Pitts. He is chief astronomer for the Franklin Institute and also functions as an advisor for the TMT, the 30-meter telescope. Derek, thank you so much for being here.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
How big of a leap is this 30-meter telescope?
It's really a quantum leap forward above other kinds of telescopes that are currently available on the planet. And it's really that big a step for 2 reasons. The first reason is, obviously, its size. Hubble Space Telescope mirror is about 2.2 meters, 2.3 meters, and everybody knows Hubble Space Telescope. The next size telescope up is an 8-meter telescope. The biggest telescopes on the planet right now are twin 10-meter telescopes, the Keck telescopes. This telescope will be 3 times that size, 30 meters. So it will be able to see objects 9 times fainter than the Keck telescopes and far, far better than Hubble Space Telescope. Now, the other thing that goes along with it is a system called the Adaptive Optics System. And the Adaptive Optics System is a way in which astronomers can essentially eliminate the disturbances caused by the Earth's atmosphere for astronomical observing with big telescopes on the ground. So it's like having a gigantic telescope that you might want to put in space because the sky is so much clearer, but instead on the ground where you have easy access to it and easy maintenance and upgrades and things like that.
Let's talk about the location of this telescope. The groundbreaking happened this week in Mauna Kea in Hawaii. Why was that location picked? And also talk a bit about the trouble there's been with the location.
Well, the location is ideal for astronomical work. First of all, the summit is at 14,000 foot altitude, so it's above a lot of the weather of the planet. That's a really good thing. Also, it turns out that the skies are very dark there. It's very cold at that altitude. And there's this wonderful laminar airflow that comes across the Pacific Ocean that can be employed to help keep the telescope components at a constant low temperature. So there isn't much change in size in any of the instrumentation or components due to temperature change from daytime to darkness. And that's a very important piece of this. So that makes it a really good site, as well as it's a really fairly central location, easy to get to, and has enough other infrastructure around it to make it a good spot to work from. There are some difficulties, though. The mountain itself, Mauna Kea, is a volcano. It's the largest volcano on the island there, on the Big Island. But Mauna Kea also is a sacred site to Native Hawaiians. And if you look back at the history of how the Native Hawaiians have revered this location, you'll find that, in fact, they actually restricted their own access to the mountaintop, let alone allowing astronomical observers with large instrumentation to, you know, reconfigure the mountaintop as has been done to accommodate the instruments that are there. So there's quite a bit of sensitivity. In fact, there's some people who really don't want the astronomers to be there with the instruments. And I'm sure that a 30-meter telescope will face the same kind of objection as the other instrumentation has.
The 30 meters refers to the diameter.
Yes, the diameter of the main light-gathering element, yes.
So how was that? How can you even begin to put something like that together?
Yeah, that's a really great question. As recently as the late 1980s, large telescope mirrors were still being cast as one monolithic single piece. There are all sorts of engineering problems that go into casting mirrors that are, you know, say, 5 meters in size or 6 meters in size. So when you start thinking about trying to make something that's 10 meters in size, you run up against these engineering limits. So the new method of casting or making these big instruments is that you make much smaller segments that you assemble together into the large size primary light gathering unit you want. In this case, 30-meter telescope will use 492 hexagonal segments, a little over a meter in size, to make up one large mirror.
Derek, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Derek Pitts is chief astronomer for the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia and also functions as an advisor for the 30-meter telescope. As we were talking about in the interview, there's been a lot of tension over the location, and the groundbreaking ceremony this week was halted by protests of Native Hawaiians. The project is expected to proceed as planned. Despite that, it will cost roughly $1.4 billion and will be finished in the early 2020s. Coming up on The Pulse, Philadelphia's Liberian community deals with the emotional impact of the Ebola outbreak.
Because every time you get up in the morning, somebody is being informed that their relatives or friends have died as a result of the Ebola crisis.
That's next on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. the constant stream of news about the Ebola outbreak can be overwhelming. This week, Thomas Duncan, the Dallas Ebola patient, passed away. Five U.S. airports are now screening passengers arriving from West Africa for fevers, and the death toll keeps rising. Philadelphia is home to thousands of Liberians and other West African immigrants. That means all this news is really hitting home for them.
Every day people are thinking about it.
I mean, I've had sleepless nights just thinking about my family, you know, back home. And
it's scary. I mean, I think about it every day, all the time. I have sisters, I have nephews, I have nieces, I have children back home.
Alana Gordon brings us this story of one individual who's been on the front lines here and abroad in dealing with the emotional impact of this outbreak.
Once a month, Victory Harvest Fellowship in West Philadelphia hosts a special service for immigrants and refugees, mainly from West Africa. Many are from Liberia.
So with all this unrest and chaos that's going on in the earth, let us stand upon our feet.
Anthony Sengbe is the senior pastor. He says it's a safe space for people to gather and share experiences.
We have a lot of family. Even today, we're just praying for the Ebola crisis. And there are people who have been part of our congregation who family members have been affected, you know, and we stay encouraging them, counseling them, and pray along with them.
Sengbe introduces me to a tall man in a white suit standing in the front row. Dr. Bangbala Sengbe is the pastor's older brother.
I just returned from Liberia. I returned from Liberia on August 12, 2014.
Sengbe is a Liberian-born psychotherapist who's been offering crisis counseling in Monrovia. He also practices here and says the trauma and stress people are experiencing abroad extends to the West African community in Philadelphia.
Because every time you get up in the morning, somebody is being informed that their relatives or friends have died as a result of the Ebola crisis. Every time you put on social media, whether it's Instagram, whether it's Facebook, whether it's Twitter, you're seeing this information. So there is a major trauma that is taking place in Liberia and in the United States, especially among the Liberian community.
The two Sengbe brothers and this church have been organizing Ebola fundraisers. Bangbala Sengbe is also planning to offer group counseling here. He's encouraging people to check in with loved ones abroad a lot, even just to talk. Sengbe says, as it is, Ebola comes at a time when Liberians are still dealing with the aftermath of a civil war that ended in 2003 and killed more than a quarter million people.
So people are already traumatized as a result of that war. Liberia has been trying to recover. Then this situation comes in again. So there is a major post-traumatic stress that is being experienced by people. People who have lost loved ones, the major thing we're doing now is that we're doing a lot of grief and loss therapy because that is what people need right now.
He says that means helping people take the time to mourn.
It's not wrong for people to grieve. People have to grieve, but you have to grieve in a reasonable period of time.
He says if grief lingers too long, it becomes its own illness. Sengbe has also been talking with people in Philadelphia about the importance of focusing on those who are still alive.
And sometimes if a relative passes off, the relative leaves children and other family members of theirs. And those responsibilities will most times fall on the American resident relatives. So we try to build their hopes here that whatever they do, they have to be strong for themselves here and for their relatives who are left behind in Liberia.
Sengbe says in addition to grief and trauma, there's also the anxiety that's tied to this outbreak. When he arrived in Philadelphia after his most recent visit to Liberia, he took a lot of extra precautions. Even though he didn't think he was ever exposed to the Ebola virus, he refrained from close contact with loved ones at first.
And it's painful that you see your loved ones and you can't touch your kids, especially being gone for 5 months. I will give you a simple example. My daughter was on her way to college. I got here, I think, 4 or 5 days before she left for college. So all through while she was here, we never did any physical touching because I was somewhere, they were somewhere. So what we used to do was what we call an air hug, hugging in the air.
He says these kinds of precautions are changing an essential part of how people in his community interact with each other.
If somebody's ill, you touch the back of their hands. If somebody, you know, if you, your child is not well, your mom is not well, your spouse is not well, you hug them. Those are the ways to express love. So right now it's a challenge. Every time I think about it, I get choked.
Sengbe says robbing people of that physical connection is even more pronounced for those with a loved one who has Ebola. He says it's one of the cruelest elements of this virus.
People are not able to express the last thing that is left in them, especially if this relative is dying. That last gratitude of love by touching.
Back inside this church in Philadelphia, Sengbe and others are turning to another core element that gives them strength, song and prayer. Sengbe says for now, he's focusing on efforts here in Philadelphia, but he plans to return to Liberia soon. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
The Pulse has been covering the local public health components and responses to Ebola. For more information on all that, visit our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Our next story explores another epidemic that happened well over 200 years ago, but the themes it brings up sound all too familiar.
There's a sense of uncertainty and fear.
David Barnes teaches the history of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He is not an expert on the Ebola outbreak. He researches past epidemics, including the public health responses. Right now, he's looking into a dark part of Philadelphia's history, the 1793 outbreak of yellow fever. We know today that yellow fever is spread by mosquitoes, but at the time, that wasn't even on the radar.
It would have been ridiculous to think that mosquitoes were part of the cause of yellow fever in 1793, simply because there are always mosquitoes in the summer in Philadelphia, and yellow fever does not always come, you know, with or without mosquitoes.
Instead, some prominent doctors were blaming a different source, and that's the subject of a little outdoor pop-up history lesson Professor Barnes hosted the other day in a parking lot in Philadelphia's Old City.
Thanks for coming. In the summer of 1793, in the space of 2 months, approximately 5,000 Philadelphians died of yellow fever. The leading theory about the origin of that epidemic was the dumping of a cargo of coffee beans on Ball's Wharf that had rotted, and the very first cases, the patients and their family members and their neighbors had been complaining for weeks about this foul odor on the wharf. Let me just read from Benjamin Rush's account of that epidemic. Mrs. Bradford had spent an afternoon in a house directly opposite to the wharf and dock, on which the putrid coffee had emitted its noxious effluvia a few days before her sickness, and had been much incommoded by it. After this consultation, I was soon able to trace all the cases of fever which I have mentioned to this source.
To better understand why people would have blamed rotting coffee, Barnes made his own batch. 50 pounds of beans spent the summer in a container in his driveway, exposed to the elements, and they became part of this history lesson.
Come on up, get a good, nice whiff, and please give us your impressions about this particular odor.
Woo! God, that's awful. I can't even think, it's so bad.
Smells a little bit like rotten sewage.
I mean, it's completely rancid. I don't know, like I'm inhaling it and I feel it sort of travel up my nasal cavity into my brain in a weird sort of way.
I get a sense of lingering vomit. Like if somebody had vomited in your room 3 days ago and nobody had cleaned it up.
I actually feel sick standing here. So to imagine that this could be the cause of a disease like yellow fever, I totally believe it.
I'm not sure we can entirely prevent misinformation. I think we can be as honest as possible about what we know and what we don't know. But there's always going to be fear and uncertainty. As long as you have a fatal disease that's essentially untreatable, you're going to have fear.
David Barnes teaches the history of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and hosted this pop-up history lesson about yellow fever and rotting coffee. Todd Bookman produced this piece.
I'm feeling mighty lonesome, haven't slept a wink. I walk the floor and watch the door, and in between I drink black coffee.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. If you catch a little television this evening, or drive past a highway billboard, or even listen to this very radio station for some time, you'll eventually get hit with an advertisement for some type of health care.
Over time, Rothman has earned the title Orthopedic Institute.
At Jefferson, we've brought together some of the brightest minds in medicine.
Call or go to cancercenter.com.
Bring your heart to Penn.
Two providers in our region recently got into a fight over one such ad, the Rothman Institute and Virtua. They are both in the business of joint replacements, think hips and knees, lucrative procedures with a growing demand. And Rothman took issue with some Virtua ads and filed a complaint with an arm of the Better Business Bureau. Their dispute brings to light bigger issues about medical advertisements, the claims they make, and how they impact patient decisions. Todd Bookman has this story.
There's nothing too novel in Virtua's commercials. Good-looking grandmas do a little kickboxing, a deep voice offers you, the viewer, the same vitality.
At Virtua, we don't cut the quad tendon for knee replacement, so you don't have to cut anything you love to do.
What these ads don't include, of course, are the realities of surgery. Incisions and infection risk don't make great advertising. But the Rothman Institute's complaints weren't about what was left out. It was about claims made in the campaign that so-called quad-sparing total knee replacement is less painful and offers people a quicker recovery. The problem here is there's not much evidence to back that up.
There's not been any studies that demonstrate that the quadriceps-sparing technique has any advantage over the course of 3 months, 6 months, a year, or 2 years to the ultimate end result. Both groups of people seem to do pretty well.
This is Dr. Jack McPhillamy. He's not affiliated with Rothman or Virtua, which both declined interview requests for this story. McPhillamy is chair of orthopedics at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine and has more than 30 years in practice.
I think I'm the only guy I know that still wears a beeper.
He looked into quad sparing surgeries a few years ago and decided it wasn't the right choice for his patients. The technique is what it sounds like. Doctors cut into the knee, but from the side to avoid the big quadriceps muscle running down the front of your thigh. McPhillamy says that can give the surgeon a smaller window to work in.
And it's a little more difficult to get exacting cuts so that the knee is in as good alignment as you can get it.
If the artificial joint isn't aligned correctly, and we're talking just a few millimeters here, that can lead to problems down the road. When Rothman complained to the Better Business Bureau's advertising division, it made this same argument. But Virtua, for its part, contends its patients do have better outcomes with quad sparing, and they point to a 99% customer satisfaction rating. It's still running the ads, but agreed to pull out the claims of faster recovery. Back when McPhillamy started med school, doctors weren't even allowed to market their services, and his orthopedic group still relies on word of mouth and referrals. But his patients are definitely being influenced by Virtua's ads.
So how often do patients come in here and say, I want quad sparing?
I probably get that question once a week, which is a testament to the power of advertising.
Florence Buchanan is one of the people who make it so powerful.
All right, we're rolling.
She's a New York-based freelance art director for big commercials you've probably seen.
Pharmaceutical, I've done over-the-counter medicines, I've done medical devices, hotels, packaged goods, beer.
Cosmetics and beauty products, the list goes on. She says crafting the drug and medical device ads pose the greatest challenge because the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, pays close attention to the promises made. Here's an example. If you're selling an erectile dysfunction drug, which Buchanan has done, she says you can't come out and say that it will rekindle romance or desire in a marriage because there's nothing on the drug label about romance or desire. Instead, the emotional benefits of an erection have to be suggested lightly, through the characters, through the scene.
You have to sort of talk in a voice that makes it empathetic to what the person's going through and present, you know, the solution as something that, you know, that will really help. It's really just how you, it's how you talk to them.
Soaring music, horseback riding, couples in a bathtub. It's aspirational. Pharmaceutical ads are very good at making promises that aren't out-and-out promises.
We know a place where tossing and turning have given way to sleeping, where sleepless nights yield to restful sleep.
They do have to be explicit about the risks, of course. The last few seconds generally sound something like this.
Side effects may include headache, upset stomach, delayed backache, or muscle ache.
Abnormal behaviors may include aggressiveness, agitation, hallucinations, or confusion.
If you see unexpected signs of early puberty in a child, or signs in a woman, which may include changes in body hair or a large increase in acne.
Hospitals and health providers that are only advertising a procedure as opposed to an actual medicine, their commercials don't fall under the FDA's regulation. Groups like Virtua and Rothman, they're still supposed to be truthful and accurate, but they have more flexibility, and they don't have to list the possible side effects like the drug ads do.
Welcome to the new age in joint replacement from Virtua. Go to gotmylifeback.org to learn more.
These types of ads offer hope for a more active life, for more time off the couch, and they appear to be working. In the past 2 decades, the rate at which Medicare recipients get a knee replacement has nearly doubled. Robert Field at Drexel University says doctors have become so efficient at knees in particular that they can wring good profit out of the $15,000 price tag. He says that's why facilities target it in their campaigns, along with usually only a few other medical conditions.
You don't usually see ads for old, frail people with cancer or with Alzheimer's or with Parkinson's. Those are not the high efficiency, high profitable diseases, so the hospitals are not going after that.
Now, the competition for those dollars isn't all bad for consumers, especially when it leads to innovation and lower prices. But an ad that stretches the truth is good for no one. And Virtua, by the way, is far from unique here. There was a small study done earlier this year looking at the accuracy of some medical advertisements, not even ones aimed at consumers. These were printed in academic journals read pretty much only by doctors. Of 50 ads selected at random, the study found that more than half of the claims being made by sponsors lacked well-supported evidence. The report offered this recommendation for orthopedic surgeons: remain skeptical of the claims being made. Patients, it goes without saying, would do well to follow that same advice. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
Coming up on The Pulse, what's changing the region's marshes?
It used to be a marsh, but now it's sunk below the waterline, and there's just like these giant pools all around our research area that the vegetation no longer grows there.
Will our wetlands disappear? Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. All right, field trip. Let's take a visit to a quiet oasis just north of I-95 and the Philadelphia Airport, the John Hines National Wildlife Refuge. Acres of open water fed by Darby Creek and the Delaware River are surrounded by marshes of cattails and wild rice. This time of year, a golden flower called Biden's is in bloom. It's a tranquil setting, but it's part of an ecosystem that's long faced threats, first from human development and now brought on by sea level rise. Carolyn Beeler looked into the history of the Tinicum Marsh and efforts to understand just how long it will survive.
Back before settlers arrived in our region, wetlands covered much of South Philadelphia and Wilmington and stretched north to Trenton along waterways. A U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service video traces the history of Tinicum Marsh.
In the 1640s, farmers from Sweden began to settle around Tinicum. They diked and drained the marshes to create grazing land for their livestock.
As Philadelphia became more urban, coal ash and trash from the growing city was dumped into marshes, raising the elevation so houses, businesses, stadiums, and the airport could be built.
As the centuries passed, the growth of Philadelphia gradually buried the marshes. By the 1950s, Pennsylvania's 6,000 acres of freshwater tidal marsh had shrunk to only 1,550.
This is a narrative that's mirrored nationwide. Since the 1600s, the Environmental Protection Agency says wetlands have shrunk by more than half in the lower 48 states, a loss the size of California.
Wetlands were historically regarded as wastelands of no value.
That's Partnership for the Delaware Estuary Science Director Danielle Krieger. She says during the environmental movement in the 1970s, attitudes toward wetlands began to shift.
People started to understand, well, not only are they important, but they might be the most important habitat type that we have.
The most important because they absorb water during high tides and storms to prevent flooding, and they filter and trap pollution and litter before it can flow downstream. Today, though we're more aware of their importance, wetlands face a threat that's harder to control than development: sea level rise. Delaware officials project up to 99% of their coastal wetlands will disappear by the end of this century. A Partnership for the Delaware Estuary report from 4 years ago puts the number estuary-wide at 25%. But Danielle Krieger says newer data is pushing estimates much higher.
Today we're at John Hines National Wildlife Refuge at the Tinicum Marsh, downstream from Darby Creek.
That's Academy of Natural Sciences wetland researcher Kirk Raper, who's on a boat in the middle of the marsh.
And we're looking at the effects of sea level rise on the marsh here.
Marshes grow in elevation by trapping sediment and producing plants that die off and add biomass to the marsh floor. Raper and his colleague Michael Archer are studying whether this particular marsh will be able to grow fast enough to stay above sea level rise.
We're going to go measure the changes of elevation of the marsh surface over time, as well as accretion rates, which is like sediment deposition.
We motor along what feels like a big pond, with the Philadelphia skyline peeking over the trees in the distance.
You can see the city of Philadelphia right there.
We turn left where a small stream branches off. Raper ramps the boat up onto land, and we get off and start trekking.
So we are pushing our way through marsh grasses and reeds.
You see styrofoam cups and plastic bottles, basketball toys from kids.
We've reached the first of three test plots in the Tinicum Marsh where there's a metal pole submerged deep into the muck.
The middle bar is going down like 30 to 50 feet below the surface until it reached hard, stable substrate.
Raper uses that stable landmark to measure the elevation of the marsh.
And that will show you the elevation currently, and then we can compare that to how it was before and see whether it's grown or it's sunk over time.
A few meters away, Michael Archer is kneeling in the mud with a silver kitchen knife, cutting a plug of soil in an area where a layer of white powdered feldspar mineral was laid out 4 years ago.
So ideally, it would be less mucky.
He pulls up a clump of mud and looks for a white line.
I'll find it on approximately three sides if I can, and then just measure from the top of the white.
Archer measures about an inch from that white line. That's soil that's built up in the past 3.5 years. But because sediment accumulation varies from spot to spot and season to season, and it's a slow process, it's too soon to say whether Tinicum is keeping up with sea level rise. Raper says 3 of the 10 sites they visit as part of this monitoring project have had significant sediment accumulation.
Things like that.
But later, back on the boat, he tells me another wetland closer to the coast appears to be sinking.
It used to be a marsh, but now it's sunk below the waterline, and there's just like these giant pools all around our research area that the vegetation no longer grows there. And then at Dennis Creek, which is in southern New Jersey on the Delaware Bay, there's this white forest because all the trees are dead where the salt water has worked its way up the marsh.
The data collected during this Mid-Atlantic Wetland Monitoring Program will help policymakers set preservation priorities for wetlands. But ecologist Danielle Krieger says with wetlands being lost here at almost an acre a day, the conservation tools in her toolbox will only go so far.
The sad fact is we are going to lose many, many more marshes than we can possibly try to stem the loss of. And so we also need to make decisions about where we're going to invest to try to stem those losses.
For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
You're listening to The Pulse. Our next story involves a singing contest.
Oh, Robert, I think you just killed my favorite song of all time.
Killed in a good way or a bad way?
Killing is never good.
Killing is never good.
It's never a happy killing.
But there was no snappy British judge at this competition. We're talking about Philadelphia's Recovery Idol. It's for people in drug and alcohol recovery who are committed to staying sober. Every year, the competition culminates in a concert in front of thousands of people at Penn's Landing. 2014 finalist Gina Albader of Kensington told us her story.
I forgive my dad for this now, but he showed me how to, like, shoot up. He didn't do it to me, he did it to himself. And he was like, you're doomed for this lifestyle anyway because it's in your veins. So I'm just going to show you how to do it so you don't do it wrong. And I was 7, and him and my uncle sat in the room and they had candles lit. Like, I remember it, like, real vividly. And then they both did it, and my uncle went right on the bed. He fell out. And I was like, oh no, he died. And my dad was like, he's fine.
Me, 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 me.
My name is Gina Albader. I was born and raised in South Philly. And both of my parents were addicts. Wait, let me see.
Me, me.
I never thought my calling would be in recovery, singing to other addicts, and it seems like it's the only thing that's working. Like, I would try like crazy things to get discovered. Like, I used to have karaoke machines and I would tape myself harmonizing with myself and then tape it over and then harmonize with that and have like a doo-wop band with my own voice. Boom, 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 doo, doo. And then I'd have me going, hey.
Hands are shaking.
I went to Kappa, and Boys to Men was, they were seniors when I was a freshman, and we were all in the same choir, so I'd be like, They were so happy that they were signed that I guess it didn't, they were, I don't care about you, girl, you know. I got accepted to Berklee College of Music, and drugs did nothing but mess up everything. 13, I started using, like, pot and liquor and pills. 21 was when I picked up heroin. Drugs are horrible, and I can't get a good job in, like, a law firm or in, like, a big business place because of my record.
Hello, welcome to Jersey Street Pizza. How can I help you?
We're open until 4 in the morning, and all the clubs let out 2 o'clock and 3:30. So we feed all the clubbers, and I found a bag of Coke on the floor last week. Just sitting on the floor, I'm sweeping the floor, and I picked it up, and I'm like, hey guys, can someone get this out of my hand? And the guy, Paul, came over, and he grabbed it, and he said, oh dear God. He's like, you know, and he flushed it, and he just made sure it was, like, out of sight. And you're just like, geez, man, can I just get one moment? And it's just, it's everywhere. On November 30th, I'll have 2 years again, so.
Is recovery alive and well in here in the city of Philadelphia?
Just wanting to do what I love to do, to be able to be happy every day when I wake up because I know I'm going to sing somewhere. You know, the recovery idol thing is, I could do that forever, like once a month. I'd be happy with that.
There's a hero. If you look inside of your heart.
As soon as I start singing, it's like you're in like a bubble and there could be like nuclear bombs going off. and nobody can penetrate that bubble. It's an impenetrable joy.
If you reach into your soul and the sorrow that you know will melt away.
Gina Albader won the 2014 Philadelphia Recovery Idol competition. She beat out 36 other contestants. Laura Benchoff produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, and Alana Gordon. Gray Tennis is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, the associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Cetullo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we always enjoy hearing from you. Email us with your feedback, your questions, your ideas at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Oh, yes.